because we are recording this conversation so that we can share it with the people who couldn't show up. And if you feel uncomfortable being recorded, there's really no choice but to exit the call. So I hope it's okay with everyone. You can always turn off your camera and then people will just see a black screen or a picture. And if that's the uncomfortable part, your face won't be on. If you have any technical difficulty, although I think everyone is so experienced with Zoom by now that technical difficulties have evaporated, which is really good from my perspective. But if you do, just message me directly and I'll see if I can help you with it. So I don't know if you got a chance to see Francois's blog on A Restless Art this morning. Francois, maybe you put a link into the chat box for people. To the URL for the blog, because it's about two things that are really germane to our conversation here today. One being the just utter not knowing of this moment in history, the sense that we have scraps of information about what we're encountering and we're trying things out, but nobody actually knows in terms of COVID-19. How long the restrictions will last, what the implications will be economically, how the world will be with so many people unemployed and suffering in other ways in it, how we mark the loss of all of these deaths and what we do with that experience. So that's a kind of not knowing. The other kind of not knowing, because I'd say about a third of us on the call are here in the United States, is that we're experiencing a double pandemic. We've had the virus come here. We've had a reaction, a response from the federal government, particularly the White House, that is beyond cruel, beyond, I have no words for how bad it's been. And in the midst of this, the second part, the second pandemic of structural racism, state-sponsored violence against Black people, has reared its head again in this country. And this time, I think in part because of the circumstances that the virus has created, and in part because the last straw is the last straw. There's been a huge uprising of opposition and proposition. A lot of people, the Movement for Black Lives notably, but a lot of people have been putting out proposals for policy changes that could be affected quickly if public will were sufficient. So we're living in this moment where we're swimming in a sea of tears, suffering, anger, and possibility grounded in all of the people who have stood up to say something and do something about what's going on. So that's our context. And I would like to say that I had confidence that the changes will be made at the official level in this country to bring about, to reverse the treatment of Black people as dispensable to the body politic, Black lives as meaningless. I don't know if that will be true or not. We have to see what happens. And that's another not knowing that we're facing here. So I think we should take a breath after that, right? So after this is it, you know, this is the world that we're living in. This is the only one that we're able to occupy right now. And the courage and the beauty, the meaning, the desire of meeting up together to say, what shall we do? How will we get through this? It's really wonderful. So thank you so much for being here. So the first part of what we're going to do this morning is just talk a little bit between Francois and myself. We had another one of these 2 weeks ago on the ethics of participatory arts practice. And there I was kind of the speaker and Francois was the facilitator. And now the roles are reversed. So I'm going to ask Francois a few questions that will help situate us in this conversation. And then we're going to open it up to you If you have questions, if you have ideas, if you have experiences that you want to share, there are a few people who wrote in advance precisely those things. And so I'm going to share a couple of the things that they wrote before we actually go on to more conversation in real time. But let's start with Francois, who is one of the most accomplished people in the field of community arts worldwide. And the busiest. I'm super, super impressed by how much work he does. And, you know, I sometimes wonder if he ever gets to like sleep and like that. And I want to know the origin story, Francois. Like, how did you become so committed? In the United States, we tend to call this community-based arts work, community cultural development. There's a lot of names. In Britain, the traditional phrase is community art. So I'm going to say, how did it become so central to who you are and to your work?
Okay, thanks, Arlene. The origin story is a nice phrase because those of us who've been around for a while probably have honed our stories into how we started in this. And I've told this story often, but so I'm sorry if for those of you who heard it before. And it was chance. I was working in London, putting on a play about human rights, unpaid the way you did in those days, using unemployment benefit at the start, we needed posters for the show, and somebody told me there was a community print shop, and I went to this place, which was on a housing estate in Greenwich, and I said, knocked on the door, and I said, can you print my poster for me? And it's the first time that I heard the classic phrase of community arts. We can't print it for you, but we can help you learn how to print it for yourself. That was literally the first thing that was said to me. And I spent the day there printing these posters. And while they were drying, Rob and Lulu, who ran the community print shop, were reading letters of application for a community arts apprenticeship, which was funded by the Gulbenkian Foundation, which has been one of my guardian angels over the last 40 years. I really liked this place and I really liked the people. So before I left, I wrote a letter of application. This was in 1981 when jobs came by writing a letter. And I got the job. So it was, I don't want to say I was lucky, but it was pure chance, because I would not have, if I'd seen an ad for a job called Community Arts Apprentice, Community Arts Worker, it was apprenticeship, I wouldn't have had the first idea what it was, what that meant. And even less would I have thought I could apply for it. So that was how I learned, and I was lucky because it was an apprenticeship. So it was a certain amount of semi-formal teaching and training. I did a couple of weeks in another organization and so on. It went from there, really.
You paused instead of stopping, but I mistook you. Go ahead.
No, that's it.
I was thinking of this friend of mine, Dee Davis, who's a longtime worker in Appalachia. He said, I went out for a cup of coffee 25 years ago and the rest is falling action. And there's some sense in which we all happened accidentally onto our callings and found enough nourishment to keep us there. I've been talking to Francois. It so happened that we got on Zoom to talk about some other things before the pandemic hit, but not that long before. So he was the first person that I was talking to who said, this is going to really change everything. you know, very early on. And that's, I was kind of like, well, maybe, maybe not. And it turned out, I think that he was right. So I want to ask you, Francois, we can't foretell the future, but in terms of the existing conditions, how would you characterize the big changes for community-based artwork going forward?
Okay, the first thing to say is that we've always been a very fragile workforce, and if you can even call us a workforce, most very underpaid, going particularly in recent years, going from project grant to project grant or commission to commission, very much on the back foot, responding to other people's demands. And part of the luck that I had in 1981 was that although community arts then was in a sense even more marginal, much more marginal, but its marginality gave it freedom of action, which meant that I could find my way into it in that way. So I think the first way that it's changed is that a huge number of people who work in community arts are really struggling now. They're struggling financially because the work that they had planned has literally evaporated like water on a hot stone. And mostly they are not able to get the government support where it exists. Often because, particularly for instance, if they're young, I mean, in the UK you can get some government support if you're freelance based on your last 3 years tax returns, but some people don't haven't been working long enough or haven't earned enough, and so that really just needs recognizing. And I think I worry a lot about who is going to be left working in this field in 6 months' time, who can be working in this field in 6 months' time. And my worry, as ever, is that it is the most vulnerable, the ones who are most fragile in terms of their career and in terms of other aspects of their life, who will not survive. So that's one of the reasons that it changes everything. I think there are three other things that I would say that, as you say, we don't know what's going to happen, but there are three other things I would say that I'm as certain of anything as I can be will happen. Okay, so the first is, I think we are now, we're traumatized societies. We have had an extraordinary and dreadful shock. A lot of people have suffered directly. They have lost loved ones in dreadful circumstances, often not being able to be with them. The other people have lost work, as I've just been talking about. They've lost ideas of what their future would be. I mean, you now have, for instance, a whole cohort of students who were thought they were going to university in the autumn, and now are wondering, do I want to go to university if I'm going to have remote teaching and the cost of all that? Where is my life? What should I be doing? The shock of discovering how fragile our whole system is both frightening but also salutary, because and I've written about what Bruno Latour has said about this, it does at least show us that alternatives are possible. This idea that the phrase that Margaret Thatcher coined 40 years ago, there is no alternative, is simply not true. And we've been shown that you can stop the economic system dramatically without everything falling apart. So that's one thing. We have an enormous amount of shock to overcome. The second thing is there's a second shock wave, which is the financial shock wave. Most of us will come out of this poorer. Some of us will come out of it much poorer. And our societies, our states will come out of this enormously indebted. There are going to be, it's not just community artists who will lose their jobs. It's florists, cafes, bookshops, small companies, people who've spent years building up a viable business, employing themselves, employing other people, who are going to go out of business. And that is going to put an enormous pressure on everything. So that affects everyone. The thing that then affects community art and community artists, people who work in socially engaged practice, all of these things, is in other circumstances, these would be circumstances in which we might feel we can at least help people process and live with and work out their feelings about through the kind of work that we do. The difficulty is our work is always about bringing people together, and we now can't do that because of social distancing. The thing that really brought it home to me was thinking I was supposed to do a creative writing project in Boston in the east of England during April and May with elderly people. And that disappeared. And I've not actually heard from the organization that was organizing it, but I was thinking, well, what happens if they contact me and say, okay, we've rescheduled it for the autumn? How can I ask people who are particularly vulnerable to this disease to gather regularly and be involved in creative writing? You know, the last time I did this, I had sometimes 15 people in a small room all crowded around a table working together. So that made me realize the consequences of the risks that we're now facing and how difficult it is going to be simply to work with people, to do any of that work that might be actually so important and so needed right now.
Thank you, Francois. You mentioned that in a different time, in a time when we could gather, processing their experience would be one important role that community artists could take in working with people in art-based methods around what's happening right now. What are you feeling is that we can do just as general categories of activity that are most needed? What roles can community-based artists fulfill in this time that are really necessary for society?
What do you mean by what roles?
Well, you know, I'm thinking of, so what do? We witness. A lot of community arts work is to unearth buried history and to say we were here and we're still here now. We console. After crisis, after tragedy, community arts work often becomes the ground for people to experience some sense of the continuity and possibility of life. We weave social fabric, you know, we dream another world in which the things that we're suffering from are addressed. For example.
Yeah, those are really good answers to the question. that's all true. That's exactly true. And you know, sometimes I think that what I can do is just by being there, just by doing something, you create a dynamic in which other people gather and start to do things because you've invited them to do that. And sometimes you hardly need to do anything. And that's a really valuable role, just by saying, well, let's do something here. And not knowing where that will spin off into. So yeah, I mean, all of those roles are really important. I've never, in my own work, I personally have never wanted to help anyone, if you see what I mean, in the sense of I've never seen my intention or my work as therapeutic. I see it as rights based, and it's about ensuring that people have have access to the skills and the means and the resources to use the arts for their own purposes, whatever that may be. There may be all kinds of outcomes that come from that, but for me, the starting point has never been, okay, I can help. So when I talk about this being a traumatized society, I'm absolutely not suggesting that community arts can go around and be kind of social therapists. I'm simply saying we can do the artwork that we can and make that available to people, and that people will use it for for their purposes, not for ours. That's what I think matters to me. That as soon as I start having purposes in this other than the purpose, than the human rights purpose of allowing people to access their rights, then I start undermining any sense of real equality between me and anyone I'm working with, because I'm starting to look at them differently, and I don't want to do that.
Yeah. You know, I admire that, and I think it's very true in terms of your practice. I don't know how much of a helper I am, but I think my take on it is a little bit different, because, for example, in this moment with what we're facing, we know that no matter what else happens, more and more people have to come out into the commons, say their own words with their own voices, take part in the sense of cultural citizenship, which needs no papers, no passports, in determining the future. And I think that often community-based arts work is what they call a threshold experience, which is that you're inviting people to do something that braids pleasure and purpose. You know, we're going to make a piece of theater, we're going to paint something together, and that it's going to be fun. It's going to be a pleasurable activity in which it will be enjoyable and enlarging for ourselves. And what a lot of people say, and what I think is true, is that once you've come into that act of co-creation with other people, the threshold is lowered to come out into civil society and engage in other acts of co-creation, which may be around art, or they may be around society in some way. So I might be a little bit more prescriptive than where you're coming from.
And to be honest, I still question, and I keep questioning my thinking, and I wonder whether my reluctance to go in that direction is wrong, and it's really difficult. I fear that it may be, well, one of the traps is that it is a projection of my privileged position and situation, where I think, well, because I had the confidence to do things, then other people can have the confidence to do things, and they don't need my help or direction in doing that. Now, at the moment, I still stay on my side of that line, but I'm always questioning whether I'm right about what I'm thinking, and whether I need to adjust it. And the other fundamental thing is, I was really young and inexperienced when I met somebody who was doing community theatre, And he was much older than me. And everything about him, everything about his way of working, I thought was the antithesis of my way of working. But I also met the people he was working with, and they were very happy and enjoying it. And the real lesson for that, which I never forgot, is there is not one way of doing things. My way is just my way of doing things. It really is. But that's also part of that respect for the other that says, I'm not entitled to tell you how you should do community artwork. You know, I can tell you, and I will say, when I think things are clearly wrong, when you're being manipulative or exploitative or things like that. But generally speaking, that still leaves an enormous territory in which people do things that I wouldn't do in a month of lifetimes. But, you know, I accept that they like doing it that way, and the people they're working with seem to like it too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing I take away from what you're saying is not so much that there's a right or wrong position there, as that this process of perpetual questioning, you know, what am I doing? What is its impact? What is best? Am I living the values that I hold to be most true? Are other people, are my relationships with other people ethical and meaningful for everybody? I mean, that self-questioning that you're saying is been your companion, I think it's a companion of all really good practitioners in this field, and maybe in these days more so than ever.
And I would say that if your work doesn't make you uncomfortable, you might not be doing the right work.
Uh-huh. Okay. What is it they say? Comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. I think that's the watchword for some people. So let's zoom out to the macro for a minute, because in this context, in both these contexts, in all of our countries, we've seen public response to crisis that has been to varying degrees adequate and relevant to who we are and the practice that we do. And I'm wondering what you think in terms of public and private resource providers right now, policymakers, what should they be doing to respond adequately to this moment?
I think that the most important thing that all anyone who wants to fund or support community arts or community-based cultural practice is, it's very simple. They should trust the people who are doing it. All of the structure that has grown up, particularly in the last 20 years, about targets and outcomes and planning and so on, is completely inimical to this, to the best of this work. Which is not to say that people who get funding have no responsibility and should just be unaccountable. I'm completely against the question of unaccountable or the suggestion of unaccountable artists. But I know this from my own past experience of working, particularly in some of the poorer parts of the world that I've worked in. The work really happens and brings benefits when you trust people to make their own judgments. And I'm always hesitant about quoting a classical author, but it's a line from a letter from Seneca, where he writes, "The best way to make someone trustworthy is to trust them." And I have seen that so many times. You know, if you trust somebody with resources, if you give them confidence, you say, "I believe that you'll do something good with this," 999 people out of 1,000 will go out of their way, will do amazing things to demonstrate that they were worthy of that trust. We all want to be worthy of other people's trust. And that's when the really good work happens, I think. And the paradox is that the arts funders largely trust the big institutions. You know, nobody ever says, well, can we really trust Placido Domingo to sing properly tonight? I might wonder about them in other respects, but not about their singing. And you know, I once coined my first law of cultural evaluation or arts evaluation. There's never been a second law, but the first law is the less money you get, the more evaluation you're required to undertake. And that's because they don't trust us in the end. They still don't trust us.
True. Thanks, Francois. Maybe you can kick us off with a couple of ideas, things you've seen or things that you're engaged in that are taking the given conditions and doing something promising with it, some element that might be relevant to other people's work.
I think there are the people who are going to find it most difficult are the performing arts, and especially dance and theatre, because those art forms are absolutely about bringing people together. And okay, you can do work which is where you can create an artistic and aesthetic language is based on distancing and rituals and so on. But I think you can only do that once, because it's so limiting in the end. So there might be work that can be done as we come out of this to build confidence, where we find ways of making meaningful dance or theatre that is able to respect those social distances. And the confidence thing is going to be really, really difficult. I know that I've seen quite an increasing amount of research showing that the one thing most of our governments have been good at doing is making us really frightened. And a lot of people are very anxious about going back out into the kinds of situations that they didn't think twice about 3 months ago. I think for the other art forms, it's easier, but we're going to have to be very imaginative. I'm in my village in France. It's a remote rural area, and one of the things here is that I'm a local councillor. And so I have a range of responsibilities, as well as my interest in cultural life. We're thinking of doing, I've suggested that we have a go at doing a version of the creative writing project I did last year, based around Joe Brainard's book called I Remember. And there are about 700 people living in our commune, but they live in about 40 different settlements spread over lots of mountains, and many of them are elderly. And so this, if it works, it will be a creative writing project which is neighbour to neighbour, people going and talking, collecting memories from each other about this community, about this place. Joe Brainard's book, if you don't know it, it's a series of about 1,500 sentences that start with the words I remember. And I did a version of it in Leicester last year, which you can find on one of my websites, called I Remember Leicester. But now I'm trying, and there's actually also a French version of it done by a French writer called Georges Perec, which is why it makes sense to do it here. Je me souviens. And so the idea is we might try and get a memory from everyone in the whole community and make a big collective text as a book that is, that stretches from the memories of 4-year-olds through to the memory. We have more than one person in the community who's over 100. But what it's really about is just getting people talking again, getting people to knock on the neighbors' doors and say, how are you? And just because we can't do the folk festivals and the food festivals and the book festivals that normally happen in the summer, none of that is going to be able to happen. So that's the kind of thing. I know there was a question, because you forwarded it to me just before we started, from somebody in rural Cornwall about creative writing and the both the possibilities that the online world has given us, because it has given, I mean, it's amazing. Look at us. We're all talking. We're all over the world and we're having this conversation. But also its limitations. And I think we're still a long way from understanding that. I wrote something the other day that struck me, that I think we have to not see the online world as a solution to a problem. Oh, wow, I can just see a fox coming down right outside my window. Just give me one. I'm gonna take its photograph and I'll try and send it to you in the chat if I can manage that. There we are. Okay. Sorry, I can't resist the fox. He's lovely.
No.
the online world, we have to understand it for what it is in itself, not for a not as a way of doing something else. So, and we still don't really understand what it's good for yet. It's too new. But what that question from the person in Cornwall made me think was about the telephone. I think we underestimate the telephone as a way of being in touch with people, particularly vulnerable people, people who are still shielding. A lot of older people are very, very comfortable with the telephone. It has its own intimacy. And one of the ideas that I came up with that I would still quite like to try in a way is to create a story circle of maybe just half a dozen people. This was during the lockdown, but where one person rings up the next person and tells them a story. That could be anything. Could be an invented story. Could be a memory of theirs. It could be something they've read. Doesn't matter. And then the next person phones up the next person until it comes back to the person who originally told the story. And you hear your story told back to you after it's been filtered through several other people's imaginations. And this was, I was thinking about this in the height of the lockdown, when a lot of people were really genuinely isolated still. And the idea that you could make a phone call and get a phone call every day that was just not, oh, how are you? What's your news? I don't have any news because I haven't been out, you know, but just a kind of sharing in that intimacy of the earpiece of a phone. The last thing I'll say, because I saw Dave Lowenstein sign in, and I don't know Dave Lowenstein, but I have watched a beautiful film about his mural work in the Midwest, which Arlene gave me. So hello, Dave. And I love that work. And I'm thinking, actually, yeah, we can get back to painting murals. I kind of gave up on painting murals, although I was trained in it, in 1985, because I couldn't see ways to achieve the kinds of things I wanted. But actually, yeah, I can. There are things you can do in visual arts. There's going to be an awful lot of empty shops that might need some murals painted on them. We have to be imaginative. One last thing I'll just say, just because I love the simplicity of it. There's a theatre company in Leeds called Slung Low, who are one of the most imaginative and creative groups of people. And in fact, I was due to go and visit them in April, and it's one of the things that I couldn't do. But they are doing, well, you can look them up and find out all the things they're doing. But one of their lovely ideas during the lockdown, while they were mostly involved in delivering food parcels to people in their part of Leeds, they said to people, we'll create a lamppost gallery. And the idea was you put a photograph on your door, you put a picture on your doorstep, we'll photograph it, laminate it and put it on a lamppost, and the whole of the community can start seeing each other's pictures as they go on their 1 hour daily exercise that we were allowed to take at that point. So we will find ways of connecting, but it's going to take a lot of imagination, and we are still going to miss being able to hug each other, you know, and that is just how it's going to have to be for a while.
Thank you so much, Francois. I want to mention just a couple of other models, because as I've been thinking about this question, I've been thinking back like 3 or 4 decades to some of the earlier projects in the British community arts movement that were inspiring to me, and that I worked on versions of in the United States, because I think they're applicable to this moment. One of them I'm thinking of is a People's Portrait Project. Back in the day, people were given the loan of point and shoot cameras and asked to capture so many exposures of, there would be a prompt, things that in your community that you love, things that need changing, or just, you know, what is emblematic of the place that you live. Now, since most people have a camera on their telephone, you don't have the hardware issue of it. And the way that kind of a project works, usually people take so many images in relation to a prompt, they upload them to you. And nowadays that could either, those could either be curated into a website, a publication, or some other kind of exhibition that people could partake of. And I like the idea of capturing portraits of our communities in this time when so many things are being revealed. So that's one thing I just mentioned. And then the other thing is, you know, so much community-based arts work is based on the sharing of stories, as Francois said. And a lot of the most interesting stories, projects I've seen take teenagers, kids who are old enough to, you know, use a digital recorder and follow a conversation and stuff like that. So it could be early adolescence or on up through those years, and twin them with older people, with elders, and have them do interviews about their experience. And now it's pretty interesting because they're two of the most affected groups by both COVID and structural racism. The old people who, for a variety of reasons, are socially isolated even more than ever, and young people who are most at risk from violence, and also whose lives, whose school is changing, who, everything about their prospects and lives are changing, to put them in conversation with each other. And then again, in the ways that were also innovative and resourceful, to make something out of those conversations, whether they're monologues, publications, whether they go with imagery or not. So I think also going back to some of the early days, the 60s and 70s and 80s community art stuff, that's still pretty well documented. There's a lot of inspiring work in there that's fairly low tech and it could be applicable to this moment. I want to start off opening it up by calling on Amber Hansen. Amber is one of the two filmmakers, along with Nicholas Ward, of the film Called to Walls that Francois mentioned. And that day is about work that Dave Lowenstein did with a number of communities in the American Midwest. And Dave put a link to the website in the chat box already, so you can find it there. I wanted to ask Amber because Amber and a number of Indigenous artists from Vermilion, South Dakota, which is a small university town in the very far north, slightly west of the United States. They did a beautiful mural with a water theme and on a wall. And there's an adjacent wall that was planned to do another highly participatory community painting mural now. And Amber and her colleagues have had to discover a different approach at this time. So Amber, can you unmute yourself and tell us a tiny bit about it?
Yeah, thank you for the introduction and for this gathering. So The mural has been designed and planned. The lead artist, Reina Hernandez, Ingrid Manny, and Elizabeth Sky led community discussions about what should be included in the mural last year. And this summer, our plan was to paint the second portion of the mural. And because of the pandemic, one of our fundraisers were canceled. And normally we would have the community come and help us paint the mural, but that has also been altered so that we can, you know, paint the mural safely. And so even though we didn't raise all the money, we're moving forward with the project because we know that the image is going to be an important and inspiring message for the community. And being in public, in a public space, we're wearing masks to protect ourselves, but also to encourage mask wearing in our community and to support safety protocols that are happening in this place. South Dakota never officially shut down. It was always open throughout this time, but our community has been really good about being cautious and creating its own precautions. But also the mural has become a place where people stop and talk to us each day as we're painting. So we've slowed down the process to allow for more people to interact with us as we're painting from a distance, and to just be there to talk with people as they're able to view our progress on their daily walks or even from their cars as they're stopping and seeing the imagery that's being represented. And the imagery is a beautiful celebration of local Indigenous culture in our community, and is something that I think will be a beautiful contribution to our town.
Thanks, Amber. Francois, did you have any question about that? Or
it sounds wonderful. I think it's just a really nice example of finding a new solution to the situation. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Amber.
When do you think it might be finished?
Right now, I mean, we started at the top of the mural because it'd be more difficult for people to access that point. And there has been talks about, you know, at some point, if we're able to gather and paint safely, we may leave bottom sections left open so that the community can put their brush on the wall. But we will be, in the next couple of weeks, I think we'll be finished with the upper portion. And I'll add a link to the box, our Facebook page. Please.
I'd love to be able to see.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. You guys, there's a number of questions in the chat box about support. Gracia, I'm probably going to mangle your name. I apologize in advance. Gracia Dyer Jalia or Halia. She's written, as you predict, I agree, it's very likely that folks who are already on the margins will need to abandon or leave this work out of necessity. What do you think is needed to prevent this from happening, and how can the process of coming up with solutions be more inclusive? I'm mentioning that because a whole bunch of people posted afterwards, some with good examples, and I'll send you guys all this chat when I send you the link to the recording so that you can see all the links that everybody put in. And a lot of people are mentioning universal basic income and other general social benefit approaches as opposed to special money for artists per se to do their work. There's a lot of this feeling of, it's being expressed in the chat box anyway, of something that lifts all ships. Francois, I wonder how you feel about those two alternatives.
I would love a universal basic income. Do you know, I read about it in a book by Rutger Bregman. And one of the things I read is that the US president who tried to bring in a universal basic income 2 years running was Richard Nixon.
I know it was Nixon, yeah.
It's just unbelievable. It just shows how the world is not what you think it is. Anyway, I think the difficulty with supporting artists as artists is, how do you decide who is an artist if you have special schemes? I think that's a real problem. But the in response to the challenge of the more vulnerable, people with more fragile careers. I'm not saying vulnerable people, but their position is more vulnerable. I'm starting to think about how we can challenge cultural institutions. And I had a conversation with one company that I'm doing a bit of work with at the moment to say, okay, maybe actually those organizations now need to start to see themselves as patrons, as sponsors. They're used to seeing themselves as people who go to patrons, who seek sponsorship, but actually compared to young professionally vulnerable artists, they are very well resourced. And so what I want to challenge the cultural sector is to, in effect, pair up with an artist or a group of artists and say, we have this amount of resources, we can support some of these people with no strings. We trust them, you know, we'll say these are now our artists in residence or our associate artists or whatever, you know, form they can find. And I think that particularly for the vulnerable, one of the, I'm thinking now a lot and I've been thinking this since before this crisis came in, but how do I make space for a younger generation, people whose experience is different to mine? And I'm trying to find ways where I can do work in partnership with other people, because if I'm being asked to do work, largely I can't. I mean, for instance, somebody wrote to me today and wanted me to contribute to a conference in September, and I really don't want to be on conference platforms anymore. But I have, in order to replace myself with somebody who's got a new voice, a different perspective, other things to say, I think I have to find ways to get the people who are asking me to ask the other people, which may mean that I have to pair up, and that may be also in my work. And I am very willing to do that, and to do that financially, to split my fees with somebody else who will work with me. But I haven't found the answer. I have how to do that yet, because I absolutely don't want to be, I don't want to be condescending and saying, you know, I can help you have a bit of my work. I don't know, but what I am saying, I suppose, is that I think the challenge is to all of us, however vulnerable or small we might feel, to see what we can do for the person next to us who's even more vulnerable in this situation.
Thanks, Francois. You know, you can always say, they offered me this and I'm busy, so I referred them to you. That's what I do, and it usually works out pretty well.
But the difficulty is, I think the people who are asking me to do things will not, like this conference, they won't accept a 25-year-old who might actually tell them some really interesting things and useful things and different things to what I would tell them. But they so think that they want what they think I can tell them. That's the difficulty.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I get what you're saying. You guys, we have a number of things in the chat box that are examples of things people are doing. Julie Ward mentioned a solidarity syndicate of migrant women, people dancing from Kiki Gale. The maneuvering of who can actually talk, I think if you either raise your little digital hand or you unmute your microphone and start talking, either way, I think you will be put onto the first screen here. So if any of those people or anyone else wants to share either an example of something that's happening now that you think might be promising and suggestive for other people, or a question that you want people to engage in. I also want to mention that Gracia, who I quoted before, said, how can more people be included in this conversation about what should be happening? And people who have responses to that, that would be great too. So I'm waiting to see
Just let me answer that question.
Yes, yes.
I mean, Arlene and I just did this because we like talking about this stuff and we think it's important. And it would be really great if all of you invited your friends and people to be talking about these things. We can do this now.
Yeah. Okay, people, I'm not hearing anybody and I'm not seeing any little hands. Is that right?
No.
Okay, go ahead. Oh, Sue, please go ahead.
I obviously last year, we put on, and Francois was actually there one of the days in our exhibition, Brilliant or Bonkers, the Counterculture 70s Bath. We were very surprised at that event, which is an archive exhibition of everything that has happened with Bath Arts Workshop, at the response of the audience, especially a lot of young students that came, who said, we don't know about this stuff. We didn't realise all of this went on. And I think it brought home this idea of, you know, look, there's an unfashionable view that looking back doesn't inform the future. And I think what that show showed us is looking back to what collectives did, you know, if you like, what collectives can do now is very pertinent. And we have the Youth Climate Strike Group, who are a collective of school children striking. And I don't know if it's in the USA, but it's in the UK with Greta Thunberg as their sort of model. And they said to us, you know, your generation did nothing. And we had a climate conference and we actually shared looking back and saying perhaps what we did is we didn't end up having enough impact. And maybe that's something you have to look at rather than blame us for not doing anything. And I think it was a very eye-opening experience for them and us to share intergenerationally what people had tried to do and that we didn't fail, which was their view. We actually possibly didn't sustain a lot of what we did beyond what we felt was a success, and therefore maybe the impact, their view, on the environment was we might have banned the bomb, but we didn't ban ecocide. So it was a very interesting conversation, and I think it's that conversation, that intergenerational, not cross-generational, conversation that needs to take place, where there isn't a blame culture, but there's actually some sort of moving forwards where you're inclusive rather than you expect the vanguard to be younger.
Francois?
It's really interesting. I don't have an answer to that. I think it's everyone feels differently. One of the things that I feel, you know, I can only speak personally, I feel strongly that I'm very happy to I do think there is a value and an importance in people understanding what happened before. And to some extent that's why I wrote the book that I did last year, to put some of that down so it's there. So I absolutely get that, and I actually think that book goes back to the beginning of the 19th century in tracing working people's efforts to have access to culture collectively, because I think we don't even remember our own history. It's really important. At the same time, I hover between these things. I'm aware that it's quite easy when you get to my age to kind of spout from great swathes of experience and knowledge and so on, and that can become as crushing of other people's ideas as so I what I'm trying to do is find a way to make what I know and what I think available if people want it, but not to be the but to have an expectation that now it is time for the younger people and people who are not like me to have to be in the center of the stage. And that's the bit I'm trying to manage as best I can without abdicating my own responsibility for what I, you know, I'm still here. I can still act. I can still do things. I mean, act not in theatre, but I could never do that. But, you know, I can still take action. So I'm not kind of retiring and say, okay, it's all over to you kids. You sort it out. We made a mess of it. You could. But, you know, it's not, it's just as so often it's fine walking that tightrope between helping and being unhelpful.
I think what I was encouraged by was their interest and sharing with us about what we saw and they were living and are living a new form of resistance. And we weren't trying to question that in any way with them, but what they were saying to us was, we wish we'd known more about this. Somehow, you know, it's not in the social fabric of our curriculum. It's not there. Our parents haven't talked to us about it. And I think that it just struck a chord in me that we're all going to experience new forms of resistance and new forms of art and engagement coming out of the fact that we're working online in these different ways. We're experiencing the liquid realm, we're exploring it, we're resisting it, we're fighting it, we're caving to it, like Zoom. But I think what's interesting is there are new forms of resistance developing. But I just do think it would be saddening to me, particularly as someone who's always worked in socially engaged practice, if we lost the intergenerational conversation and people were debarred in some way from contributing.
Absolutely. I really like Arlene's point before about the witnessing and getting younger generations and older generations to talk about it. This, I think we have a big job to do in telling the story of what we've been through. Some of the best projects I've been involved in have made that connection between teenagers and grandparents, that where there's often misunderstanding. I'm talking about not in their own family. In their own family, it's fine. But, you know, those generations are often slightly wary, if not frightened, of each other. Mm-hmm. And actually, I've seen really good creative projects that have helped them realise that actually they have a huge amount to offer each other, and they can be fantastic.
Yeah, I was, for half a dozen years, I was something called Chief Policy Wonk of the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture, which was an artist-run project that sort of impersonating the public cultural policy presence that we should have in this country. And my colleagues were all 40 years younger than me. And that turned out to be a really good challenge for us, because what we said was, let's try to find language that speaks to your generation and younger, and my generation and even older, if there are any people around like that. And I thought we did. I thought we were able to find that language. And I don't think they could have known how to talk to my generation if I wasn't there, and vice versa. So I also see some, you know, really meaningful role in that. There's several questions and messages in the chat box. I want to speak to one for a second, and then I'm going to call on people to do the next. Elle or Ellie Weekend said, can anyone speak to how this predominantly white group of leaders can play a significant and meaningful role in the racial divide? And I'm not sure if you mean the people on the call or, you know, in general, white community arts people. I don't actually know who all is on the call. There's four screens, and many people on the last screens are blacked out. They aren't showing their faces. But it doesn't really matter if they're on the call or not, because the question is really good for every context. And I think it's a really, really important one for us to be aware of as community-based artists, that white supremacy is created by people of pale complexion and enforced by them and evolved by them over decades and centuries. And that creates really, really important roles for people who are put into those racial categories, who see themselves as part of those racial categories, to work on those structures of power and to work with other people who are themselves not people of color, to bring to awareness the extent of the oppression that white supremacy has created, speaking as an American in the United States, and to direct people to support the organizations and platforms and programs to respond to that. I mentioned Movement for Black Lives. They're doing amazing work right now, and also calling on the president to resign in a way that's gone very viral, which I think is really important. So I think it's essential to just be aware that there's a lot of work to do, and that work needs to be following the lead of the people who are most directly affected by racial oppression and piling on resources, attention, dialogue work, money to the causes that they're directing us to. But that's just my two cents. Judith Marcuse, you brought up coalitions with non-arts organizations and movements. Did you want to elaborate on that question a little bit? And if you do, you should unmute yourself.
Hi, everyone. Sorry for the delay. I would be really interested to find out what kind of partnerships, coalitions, people on the call have engaged in that have a more extended reach or impact, or could potentially have that as a consequence of those collective endeavors. Here in Canada, there's a lot of work with health sector, with immigrant organizations. I won't go through the list, but I'd be really interested to hear people's experiences with coalitions for positive change.
Would anyone like to respond to that? And Francois, maybe you have some experience with that as well.
Sorry, I was reading the chat.
It's hard to read and hear at the same time, but basically Judith was talking about artists, and especially artists who are committed to social change, working in coalition with non-arts organizations or movements, and what are people's experience with that?
I'd like to let other people answer that question.
Okay. Yeah, anybody feel like it? David, Diamond, yeah. Unmute.
Well, interestingly, Judith and I are old friends, and she's going to know what I'm going to say, but when my theater company was up and running, I just shut it down 18 months ago, we never had a full-time publicist. We had a full-time outreach coordinator, and it wasn't that person's job to put bums in seats. It was that person's job to develop and nurture honest relationships with community organizations. And when I say that, I mean that there were times when we would go, oh, you know, there's this organization and there's this organization. Do you two know each other? No, you should talk to each other. And that would have nothing to do with anything we were doing. And so it wasn't a matter of us asking them to do us favors so that people would participate in our projects. But what it led to was them being deeply invested in the work we were doing, because it helped them fulfill their mandates. So anytime we did a big project, there might be, like, I mean this, 100 different organizations attached to that project. And they would come and go based on projects, you know, because subject matter changes. And what that meant was our audiences, and I think I can say this, you know, were some of the most diverse audiences in every way you can think of in Vancouver. Because we weren't in this echo chamber of publicity, we were being put forward by community-based organizations who didn't just believe in our work, but it was because our work was helping them fulfill their mandates. And I think it's for lots of arts organizations, a different way to approach it, not as publicity.
But as relationship building. Thank you, David.
I watched online earlier today. Some of you will know Nina Simon, who's now has set up and organized. She was running the museum in Santa Cruz and now has set up an organization called Of By For All. And she gave a keynote to Opera America, which you can find on YouTube. Just she did it 2 or 3 days ago. And I was very interested to see how that museum had been doing a kind of Day of the Dead celebration, but had realized that most of the people who came were not Latinx, which is a new word that I've learned today from that talk, and the process by which they actually transformed that by giving, in effect, giving the celebration over to a community organization that then was inviting the museum to take part in it, rather than the museum organizing the Day of the Dead celebration. And I just think it was an interesting example of changing those relationships so that cultural organizations become are not inviting other people in, but are empowering other people and then following their lead.
Thank you, Francois. And Judith, you wanted to follow up with David, I think?
Just simply to say that I think the whole area of partnerships, coalitions, intergenerational coalitions in particular, are really important right now. Our experience right now with a national mentorship program, which puts early middle career artists into working with environmental organizations across the country, is bringing up a whole bunch of questions around how best to create these kinds of partnerships, what kind of languages work in various contexts. I think there's a whole area of investigation that our sector could really profit from in terms of those processes that lead to successful relationship building and sustainable relationships with people who are not necessarily or don't self-identify as artists in their change work.
Thank you, Judith. Ed, Carol, I'm going to call on you next.
Yeah, sorry, I had to unmute myself. I go back to the question of how people are surviving, let's say, in this field of practice, who aren't employed and who aren't getting paid for what they're doing during this time. And it's very interesting because it seems to me one of the things in this COVID pandemic has, which is different, let's say, when the Great Recession struck 10 years or so ago. One of the things is, in this debate, the question of equality has come out much stronger, it seems to me, because it's very clear that COVID is hitting those who are least able to fight back. You know, people with underlying health illnesses, older people. And so there's a whole, you know, also in terms of, let's say, race, this question of equality comes out very strongly. And so a question that always hits me now is, look, taking it that an awful lot of the arts and cultural armature that's there, the funding armature of projects, of commissions, it never really resourced this field of practice. And I don't know that it's suddenly going to start resourcing this field of practice. So the question I have, let's say, addressed really to people who are really on the edge as practitioners is, well, look, where are you going to look to resource this type of work? And I think that's I think that's a really wicked problem. And I don't really have any quick or easy answer for it. I do think very, very briefly that the area of the black economy, which holds a lot of activity that are for public interest, sometimes it comes out into the white economy as social enterprise and social economy. But I think that an awful lot of the work that we do as community arts practitioners, which is not paid, it's not funded, but it's somehow or other, it's within the area of the black economy that I think we have to take certain things out of it and bring them into a different order, you know, as rather than something illegal. But I really have a big, big question about the cultural infrastructure that's there is not going to be the answer to resolve the problem of the very vulnerable arts practitioner at the moment.
Yeah, thank you, Ed. Francois, I want to add something from the chat box before you respond to that, okay? Usman Kazi has posted a point, which is true in my country as well, about the big funders wanting to celebrate diversity but not really wanting to support artists of color to engage in the hard work that really needs to be done. And she's asking a question, which is what real movements are out there that are willing to question and call out the big funders? And that's a challenging question. If you want to get money from them, usually people don't nibble on their hands. So we have, you know, they're independent folks. I think Francois and I have both been that have been free to criticize because we don't get money from those funders, but how else? So Francois, the whole question of how will the sector be supported given the nature of the existing structures, and then who is positioned to actually call out the injustice of that?
Oh gosh. I mean, there are people. Last year, I worked with a very interesting Muslim organization called Maslaha, and they'd asked me to write a report on their project called Muslim Girls Fence. So it's about the sport of fencing, which is largely seen as a very white aristocratic male domain, and they've been doing projects getting young Muslim women to learn fencing, and that was a really interesting but also challenging in a good way project. One of the most obvious things was that, you know, I couldn't see any of the work because I'm a white man, and the whole point of those projects is to create a safe space for young Muslim women to be together and explore art and identity and politics, and within the framework of a sporting activity. And what I ended up agreeing is that I would do it with three of the women from Maslaha, and we wrote it together. I did a lot of the writing part of it, but it was all done through discussion and documentation and so on. And it was challenging for me because we had some tough conversations about what they wanted to say and what I felt comfortable saying. And I think, I hope we both learned, we all of us learned from that experience. And you can, I think you can probably find the report online if you search for Maslaha. I don't know for sure, but if you put Muslim Girls Fence, you'll find their website, and it's a really interesting, thought-provoking thing. I don't have answers to any of these things. I think they're, and to Ed's point, at the end of, in the penultimate chapter of the book I did last year, A Restless Art, I wrote about what I now think of as the new generation of people who are making community arts, who are very often not in the UK, although some of them are. And I see in Eastern Europe and Southern Europe a lot of people who've really had a terrible time, young people particularly, who've had a terrible time, at least since 2008 and the financial crisis, in some cases in Eastern Europe longer than that, and who have been radicalized in the best way by that experience. They often don't trust their governments and so on, but they know that they must do something themselves, because otherwise nothing will change in the places where they live. And I deeply admire their work, and I call that chapter Without Help, Without Permission, because that seems to, it's exactly that tension of, you know, if you want help for your work, you have to ask permission. The money always comes with strings. And I'm really wary of talking about this, because the last thing I want to do is to say the best work happens without funding, and let the funders off the hook, and say, and or to underestimate how difficult it is. But there is a reason why there have now been successive generations of people working in community art, and the energy does very often come from people in their 20s, not least because in the lives that we live, that is typically when we have least dependence or fewest dependence. We can live on least amount of money. We have that. Some of us have the fearlessness of the young, and you have energy, and you can invest yourself in what you believe in. And I admire those, without wanting to say for a minute that that's how it should be. So the work that Ed is talking about, that I don't want to call it voluntary work, unpaid work, that activism that is motivated by people wanting to make a change, I admire it immensely. And interestingly, sorry, I've been talking a long time, I'll just round this off. One of the things I did some years ago was a little book about art and agency in old age, and that put me in touch with some of the people from who had been young in the 60s, who had been activists and people who'd invented what we now call community arts, who are now actually free to do it again, because they also now don't have dependents, and they have pensions, they have state pensions. None of them have the kind of nice pensions that people who work in local government end up with. But they do have at least state pensions, and that's giving them the freedom to do work again without having to be accountable to a funder. So anyway, that's, sorry, too long.
Thank you, Francois. You guys, we have 3 minutes, so I sadly cannot call on anyone else. I want to wrap up and give Francois an opportunity to wrap up. In my wrap up, I want to say part of the reason I still believe that there's a possibility of at least holding the feet of public funders to the fire, whether they burn or not, we'll see. But I've been trying to do it for my whole life, and I'm not going to give up now. And I think one of the big obstacles is that people who are hopeful of getting money from them don't want to offend them, and so don't speak truth to them. So this question of what are the ways to organize that protects individuals and organizations from retribution, but but speaks truth. And I would just say that there have been many times in history in which, during the 40s and 50s, they called them committees of correspondence, where people got together in a framework like this, a reasonably small group of people, and talked about the same big questions at the same times and shared their responses with each other and developed a feeling of unanimity or consensus at to a point where they were able to actually force some change in how resources were allocated. And the thing is that who are Francois and I? We're self-authorizing, as we said at the beginning. We just decided people want to talk, let's have some conversations. So you can now do exactly this. You can publish a little bit of writing from people who have something interesting to say about it, invite folks in your network, have another conversation like this, see if action emerges out of that. I would just encourage you to be self-authorizing in that respect as you have been in your work, and to be aware that, you know, the perfect is the enemy of the good. No matter what we do, some people are always excluded. It's always partial. We didn't always get to everything that we wanted to handle, and yet it's really good to keep trying. I appreciate everyone for showing up and doing that. And Francois, I'm going to hand it over to you to say a few words in closing.
I just wanted to say I've sent Arlene the fox because I can't put the picture in the chat box. I don't know why it doesn't seem to want to have pictures. So we'll send you the fox.
Yeah, you can't put pictures in the chat box, but we'll send it. Yeah.
And I just want to say thank you very much for coming and being part of this. I'm just very grateful. If I've sometimes been distracted, and I have, I've sometimes lost the thread of what we're talking about, it's because there's so much really, really interesting stuff in the chat box. And I want to thank everybody who's put links in there and talked about their projects, and I've just got a glimpse of it, and I will read all of that and we'll send that to everyone as well afterwards. So yeah, I just I'm grateful that we can still, that we have this platform, this Zoom thing, that we can meet, and it is amazing, because I did think a while ago what this would have been like when I was a young community artist, and if I'd been locked up on my own at home for 10 weeks, I'd have probably gone mad. Whereas at least I've been able to be in touch with people, and I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah, I'm kind of waiting to when we can beam up, because I think that might be the true solution to our problems. But sadly, Star Trek has not been extended to real life so far. We, like Francois said, we'll send you the link to the recording. We'll include the link to the recording of the ethics conversation that we had 2 weeks ago as well, because several people have asked for that, the fox picture and the chat. The question of can we do it again? I think Francois and I need to talk about what's next, but we're totally open to ideas, I would say, and maybe giving some other, maybe moderating some other person or persons being the main speaker would be the next thing to do. So please be in touch with us and let us know what you think will be good. And we wish you all well. We honor the integrity and presence that you're bringing to your work. We honor the way that you keep trying under the hardest conditions. Thank you for all that you are and all that you do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.